Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. I've always been fascinated by the San Andreas Fault, and one of the best books I've ever read about it was the 2014 book Earthquake Storms, The Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault by John Dvorak. I shared the book with my friend Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey when we were working on a program about the Haywired scenario, a simulation of a massive earthquake on the Hayward Fault. Hudnut, like me, loved the book, and serendipitously, he ran into Dvorak at Volcano House, an historic hotel on the rim of the Kilauea Caldera during the summer eruptions of 2018 on the Big Island of Hawaii. Ken was there coordinating helicopter observations. Dvorak is also the author of The Last Volcano, A Man, A Romance, and The Quest to Understand Nature's Most Magnificent Fury. It came out in 2015 and tells the story of the Hawaii Volcano Observatory's first volcanologist, Thomas Jaeger. Ken and John hit it off, and Ken told him about our show, and he agreed to join us. Our conversation ranges over a wide array of geologic phenomena, but definitely focuses on the San Andreas Fault and the fascinating people associated with it. I hope you enjoy it. Ken and John joined us from Southern California via Skype. Ken Hudnut and John Dvorak, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, hello, everybody.
Hi. Nice to be back.
And it's nice to have you. John, I'd like to start out, but I'd like to know how you first got interested in the topic of earthquakes and volcanoes. You know, what really sparked your interest in plate tectonics and all of this phenomena?
Well, I started, what motivated me was very different from most people. Ever since I was very young, the earliest memory I have is being interested in numbers. I like counting. I like how they were arranged. And when I went to college, this was during the transition period between what was called, what we can call the old geology, and then the plate tectonics or the new geology. And old geology, as you recall, 19th century, early 20th century, that consisted mostly of people learning to identify rocks and minerals, and then going and applying that to draw geologic maps. And that personally didn't excite me. But during the revolution of plate tectonics, I saw that people were doing measurements. They were making models. They were using numbers to actually understand Earth evolution, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and so forth. And it was that part, the part to be able to quantify Earth science. And if you think of it, plate tectonics, it was also the revolution changing in geology from classic geology of rocks and minerals into quantifying earth sciences.
And when did you first get specifically interested in writing a book about the San Andreas Fault?
Well, I went to Caltech in Pasadena as an undergraduate. But I didn't grow up in California. And so when I came to California, one of the things I learned being in the Los Angeles area is this sort of pride about earthquakes. And not being a Californian, it was a bit peculiar. And so I kept wondering about this. And it finally struck me that a big part of culture in California today is earthquake culture. There's sort of a pride about living in earthquake country. And so I started researching exactly what is the San Andreas Fault. In part because it plays a big part in the history of California, 1906 San Francisco, and it's going to play a big part in the future of California. There's going to be a time, sometime in the future, a day, a year, 10 years or so, and there's going to be a new California, and that's going to be after the next rupture of the San Andreas Fault. And it's that future rupture that really intrigues me.
And Ken, you know, I'd like you to chime in on that.
Intrigues me too. Yeah, I guess people talk about preparedness, and there's the new podcast, the big one by KPCC, Jacob Margolis, for example, a lot of that is about personal preparedness, how to be ready for a big one. And as a scientist, what I get into is trying to be ready scientifically. What that means is everything from having an inventory of all the equipment that we have and keeping it all ready to go just in case, to get out there and put portable instrumentation in the field, but also things like how can we use new technologies to, for example, image the San Andreas Fault. We used LIDAR on an airplane and made incredibly detailed topographic maps along the San Andreas Fault. So as we apply new technologies, this is part of how we as scientists get ready for the big one.
Can that really, yeah, that intrigues me, and I'd never really thought about that, but could you just kind of briefly tell us when the big one happens, and we know it's a when, not if, and there in Southern California, this big rupture that you're expecting, could you just kind of tell us what will be the protocol of, like, what will you guys do right after that? What will that look like?
Well, our first thing is we rely totally on our sensor network that's in place and always operating automatically. And we will expect our system to stay up and handle the hit of a big one. And we hope to get a lot of really good information instantly from our network. And we hope that our products will all be, you know, quickly generated, things like the location, the magnitude of the event. But it is possible that parts of our data telemetry system will get knocked out. We don't expect our system to get through a really big earthquake without incident. And so just like with the Northridge earthquake of 1994, we expect to take some hits, and our automation may not work perfectly. But we do try. That's our job here, is to operate that network of sensors, keep everything running, and keep perfecting our automation.
Let's get back to the San Andreas Fault, the beast that lurks beneath. And I'd like to ask you, John, about the, one of the things I love about your book is that it's a story of people and not just science. It's the story of people and they're helping us to understand what the San Andreas Fault is and the phenomena around earthquakes. So I'd like to start out, but I know both of you are very interested in this. Tell us, Ken and John, about the role of Andrew Lawson in the first identification of when this thing became identified as a geologic structure and how it got its name.
Well, Andrew Lawson, he grew up in Canada, but he became a professor of geology at UC Berkeley in the 1890s. And he was looking around, obviously, for something to do, and he became interested in the geology just south of San Francisco. In particular, the reason he was interested in it is that it was the only place in California with a deposit of mercury sulfide, which was essential for gold production. And so he started mapping the area. But what he found, and if you fly out of San Francisco Airport, you see this long, narrow valley, and which is known as the San Andreas Valley. And when he saw that, on opposite sides of the valley are different types of rocks, which is a signal there's something interesting here. And through various sleuthing, like a detective, he determined, and this is in the early 1890s, that there was not only a large fault, but that it had recently ruptured. And that's pretty much all that he knew about it up to the 1906 earthquake.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking to John Dvorak. He's the author of a book called Earthquake Storms, about the San Andreas Fault, and Ken Hudnut, our good friend from the United States Geological Survey from Pasadena. Ken, anything you want to add to the story of Andrew Lawson and the San Andreas Fault's identification?
Well, I just love how John describes those early adventures along the fault by Andrew Lawson in the book. And I remember you telling about the sag ponds that he and a student identified along there. And it's just such a wonderful story of discovery. And for me also, I'll add that when I was reading some of the works of G.K. Gilbert, I came across a footnote in his writings, and he described the Hayward Fault, which is on the other side of the San Francisco Bay Area, one that we also have come to name subsequent to G.K. Gilbert's writing, but also we've come to appreciate that it also represents a significant threat to the Bay Area.
Well, you mentioned the central character that I want to talk about, and I know he's a hero to both Ken and I, and probably you too, John, and that's Grove Carl Gilbert, the great American geologist. He really is an essential part of the story, and the more I learn about him, the more amazed I am. Ken sent me some interesting emails today with some research about Grove Carl Gilbert and his contributions to earthquake science. They can't be overstated. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. His writings, even in 1883 and then subsequently, are just prescient, and his insight into how faults work, the friction, and how that was an essential part of understanding the process by which mountains are built, one earthquake at a time. When I was rereading this, I couldn't believe it. He really had a lot figured out very early, and so far ahead of time, before plate tectonics and the revolution that John was describing. It's just, I marvel at it when I read his works, and it's just almost like poetry. You know, some of the early writings on plate tectonics were referred to as geopoetry too, but G.K. Gilbert's writings were kind of geopoetry before it got called that.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey and geophysicist and author John Dvorak. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue our visit with two geophysicists, Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey and author John Dvorak, as we talk about the San Andreas Fault and plate tectonics. John, one of my favorite parts of your book is the story of G.K. Gilbert, and let's just set the stage. He has never experienced an earthquake. He says, you know, that every geologist wants to experience, you know, these grand things, a glacier, a volcanic eruption, and he's witnessed those things, but he's never experienced an earthquake. And then it's the morning of April 18th, 1906. Tell us where he is, and then let's talk about the story of how this unfolds and his amazing friend, Alice Eastwood.
Yes, Grove Carl Gilbert. He was sent out here by Theodore Roosevelt, early 1906. There was a concern about the mining that was going on in the Sierras, silting up the Bay Area. And he was to prepare a report to determine if the mining should be continued or not. So he was staying at the faculty club at Berkeley. And that's right. He said that any geologist wants to see a volcano erupt, wants to walk across a glacier, and wants to feel a strong earthquake. And he had seen both volcanic eruptions and had walked across glaciers in Alaska, but the earthquakes kept missing him, or he kept missing. He was up in Alaska in 1908. He left a couple months before there was a large earthquake there. He missed a very large earthquake. I forget which one the one in 1872, Owens Valley. He missed that one by about 2 months. He was on the East Coast. But 1906, he was lying in bed early morning, faculty club, And with great elation, he says, the earth starts to shake. And as he lies in bed, he watches the water in the water pitcher flow out. He listens to all the creaking that's going on in the building. And the man is simply elated to finally feel a strong earthquake.
And he's doing what the classic, you know, being a classic scientist, isn't he, Ken? He's observing all of this and noting these things and even noting them in his notebook.
He was a great observer, you know, and to read his footnote that I mentioned in his classic paper called Earthquake Forecasts, that footnote in which he describes the Hayward Fault, that fault goes right next to right where he was staying at the time of the 1906 earthquake. So yeah, a great observer. He could use his words, but also he could sketch. He also learned how to take photographs, and this was in the early days of that new technology. And so he used these ways of conveying to others. But more than that, I think what I really admire is just his insight, not only observing, but then putting it all together and figuring out the geological process of earthquakes in particular. That's what I've been reading about most recently. But yeah, for him to experience the 1906 earthquake at close range like that, and then the way he conveyed that excitement through his writings, I just love it.
And then at the same time, John, can you tell us, his thoughts turned immediately across the bay to someone that he cared deeply about. Tell us about Alice Eastwood and where she was on the morning of April 18th, 1906.
Yes, Alice Eastwood, she was a botanist for the California Academy of Sciences. And she lived on the third story loft in a building on Nob Hill. And of course, everyone in the Bay Area felt the earthquake as she did. And since she was on solid rock, there was strong shaking, but it didn't do much damage. It broke some of her dishes, and she got dressed and headed down to the office of the Academy of Sciences, which was then on Market Street. And by the time she got to Market Street, she noticed that everybody was moving in the other direction. They were carrying bundles. Most people were walking in silence. And she could also see the start of the fires. Now, on the other side of the bay in Berkeley is Grove Carl Gilbert. And essentially, all communication has been lost between the East Bay and San Francisco. But by mid-morning, what they can see are the fires starting. And they also saw boatloads of people coming over with fantastic stories of buildings have crumbled and fires are rampant. And it took him something like 2 days to actually find a way across over to San Francisco. But by coincidence, on the second day when he crossed to San Francisco, Alice happened to make a move across the bay to Berkeley.
So they missed each other.
So they probably missed each other on the first one. And then when he got back that night, she went immediately to Berkeley, and they probably met up at that point.
And the two of them, as I recall, were members of the Early Sierra Club, which was basically a hiking club in California. And they had met that way. And they really hit it off. They had a very deep, loving friendship, didn't they?
Yes. And as most relationships go, it was complicated. It was complicated in that he was considerably older than she was. But they were both early members of Sierra Club. They met in 1903. Sierra Club sponsored a hike up Mount Whitney. And they immediately were attracted to each other. But the difficulty, among the difficulties, Grove Carl Gilbert was then a widower. And he had been married for 10 years. And shortly after he was married, his first wife took ill. And so it was mostly 10 years of tending to his first wife as she just very slowly died. And so this romance that developed between Alice Eastwood and Gilbert, Gilbert was always a bit distant. And he told her, the reason that I'm distant from you is that I'm concerned if we get close and I get sick, I'll just become a burden for you. And their friends expected them to get married, but they did put it off. They put it off for 15 years. And finally in 1918, Gilbert, who worked for the Geological Survey in Washington, D.C., and Alice Eastwood, who, as I mentioned, worked for the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, Gilbert finally sent her a telegram. It simply says, "Will you marry me?" And she sent him a one-word answer, yes. And so he got on a train. He crossed the country, and whenever he crossed the country, he always stopped in Jackson, Michigan, and spent a couple nights at his sister's house. And on this trip, he took ill all of a sudden, and he died. And in many ways, that's a lesson to all of us, to not postpone the things that are passionate in your life, especially when they involve other people.
Yeah, just a heartbreaking story. Let's go back to 1906, before that, and tell us about Alice Eastwood and her heroic saving of this. She has this immense botanical plant collection there at the California Academy of Sciences, and she almost single-handedly, heroically saves all of these specimens. Could you tell us briefly about that?
Oh, yes. By the time she got down to Market Street, people were, of course, streaming away. The fires were approaching, and at first the front doors were locked, and she ran around the block trying to find a way in. By the time she got back to the front door, the director of the academy had shown up, and he opened the door, and they all rushed in, and the California Academy of Sciences building was a six-story building, and in the center, it had a grand staircase. And her office was on the sixth floor. But because of the earthquake, this entire staircase had crumbled, except for the banister. And so she climbed up in bloomers six stories because she had up there all of her plants. And she arranged a way with the pulley system and a rope to lower all of her specimens, 1,472 specimens, down to the floor. And then she climbed down. And when she got them all outside, she remembered the previous day she had removed one of the samples, a sage that she had found up in the Sierras. And she made a climb a second up to the sixth floor just to go and retrieve this one sample, and came back down. And by the time she left the building, it was literally starting to burn. And it's a rather detailed as to what she did next in terms of finding a way to transfer all of these samples. She first took them to Nob Hill, and she spent the whole night surrounded by her samples and listening to the explosions as people were trying to contain the fire.
Yeah, they were dynamiting the buildings.
That's right. Between the bright lights of the fire and the dynamiting of the buildings. And she was there at Nob Hill. And for the second day, she was able to find somebody with a wagon. And she had all the samples taken down to the Presidio. And of course, she went back and spent one more night, and she packed up what she could in her suitcase. And she would write, "I packed some dresses, the Bible owned by my mother." And then thinking she might have to sleep outdoors, she also packed her revolver. And she left her apartment. And it, of course, was consumed later by the fire.
She's really quite an amazing outdoors woman. She was, I believe, was she the first woman to climb Mount Shasta solo?
As far as I know, she did. Yes. She was born in Colorado in the 1870s. She came out to California to be the botanist at the Academy of Sciences. Her first year here, 1893, and I've often tried to figure out exactly how she did it, but she went out and she climbed to the top of Mount Shasta all alone. She had two passions in her life, and that was mountain climbing and it was botany.
And I love the story how she basically like had a burlap sack or something wrapped around her for the trip up, and then she just slid down on the sack all the way down Mount Shasta, which is how a lot of climbers come down after they climb, which is pretty amazing to think about, visualizing this 19th century woman coming down the mountain in her dress.
And she did it in bloomers. That's right. She went and she made her own backpack. She made her own a sleeping bag, and she took off and decided to climb Mount Shasta without maps and really any experience in the area.
Wow. Well, let's talk about what happens right after the earthquake, because G.K. Gilbert hooks up with Lawson. Could you tell us about his role immediately after the earthquake? Because Alice plays a big role in that too, doesn't she?
Right. Well, a series of trips over to examine the surface fault rupture took place, and the sort of the home base of operations was the Berkeley Faculty Club. Letters were written from there, and he would report to Lawson on new findings. And as I mentioned, he had learned how to do photography, and so in the early days of that technology, it was quite something to just simply take a photograph. You really had to be organized about it with all the right equipment. And Alice would accompany him on these trips over to the San Andreas Fault. Together, they would make observations, and G.K. Gilbert would do the photography, and Alice would stand along the fault rupture in some of these photos and part as scale, but also these resulting photographs are just incredibly classic photographs of surface fault rupture, and that's Alice that we see in those pictures. You know, some of the listeners may have seen the famous pictures of the 1906 earthquake that were taken on those expeditions, but those were very much, you know, scientific expeditions in which Alice was very much a part.
And some of those photographs are amazing. Could you guys just kind of tell us a bit about some of the scenes? Because he kind of uses Alice for scale, doesn't he?
Yes. One of the big features of the 1906 earthquake was called the mole hill, because it looked like a giant mole had burrowed in the ground. And it extended for well over 100 miles. It was the sliding, well, today we know that it was the sliding of the North American plate and the Pacific plate. If I could add, Alice actually wrote an autobiography, which is unpublished, and it does sit in the archives at California Academy of Sciences.
Wow. Well, there you go. Maybe I should go do that. Let's talk about another interesting character in your book. Let's go to Southern California. And a guy named Levi Noble, he has a ranch out right on the San Andreas Fault at a place called Val Yermo. And I found that interesting because it's a place where you can really see this amazing offset. And Ken, if you could talk about it a bit too, about how the rocks are so different along the San Andreas Fault there. And it must have been so curious to geologists before they really understood what was going on. So could you start, John, by telling us just a bit about who Levi Noble was?
Well, Levi Noble, he came from a very wealthy family in New York. He was extremely shy. The people who I talked to who knew him said, if there were two people in a room, that was too many for him. So he was extremely shy. He came from a wealthy family. He attended Yale College, and he was there for 6 years because he wasn't in any hurry of leaving. But the epiphany of his life came when he took a geology course, and the geology professor at Christmas was going to go to Arizona. And he asked if anybody wanted to go along, and Levi was the only one who had any money, and so he went along, and the epiphany of his life was seeing the Arizona desert and the Grand Canyon, and he was sold on the West at that point. Now, the way that he got to understand the San Andreas Fault is that he was eventually introduced to a woman whose family had made a great deal of money in real estate in Hollywood in the early 1900s. And she was also extremely shy. And the two of them married, and her father gave the wedding couple a choice. They could either have about 10 acres of land in what is now Hollywood, or they could have a fruit ranch out on the desert. And they decided that even in 1910, there were too many people in Los Angeles for them. And so they moved out on this fruit ranch, which happened to be straddled the San Andreas Fault. The rupture of, that's 1857, as I recall.
Yep.
And that's what Levi started to become fascinated, both with the Grand Canyon and with the San Andreas Fault. So much with the San Andreas Fault that the land that, which he got from his father-in-law, had a very nice farmhouse. But he built a separate house for his private work, and he made sure that that it was constructed exactly on the 1857 rupture. And he put in two large windows, one looking to the west and one looking to the east, so that if the ground started to shake, he might be able to actually see the rupture.
Wow. You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. After a short break, we'll resume our conversation with author John Dvorak and our friend Ken Hudnut from the U.S. Geological Survey. Stay with us. Let's get back now to our visit with author John Dvorak. His two books, Earthquake Storms and The Last Volcano, deal with some of Earth's most fundamental forces, earthquakes and volcanoes. Joining us is Ken Hudnut. Ken is the science advisor for risk reduction at the United States Geological Survey in Pasadena. I'd like you guys to discuss the interesting offset of the rock formations that Levi Noble noticed while he was down there.
The Mormon Rocks and
Devil's Punch Bowl.
That's right.
Tell us about those.
It's beautiful how you described it in your book, John. I think you know this all better than I do.
Yes. Right next to is to the fruit orchard, the ranch which Noble had. Off to the west is a very spectacular place known as the a Devil's Punch Bowl, with a sandstone with a very characteristic forms to them. And he noticed that if you go over by Cajon Pass, which I recall is something like 20 miles east, on the other side of the San Andreas Fault, there were similar rocks appearing. And so back in the 1930s, he made this outrageous claim that perhaps there was as much as 20 miles of displacement there. Well, it was a very bold suggestion. But today we know that Devil's Punch Bowl and Mormon Rocks are not related, and that the actual displacement along the San Andreas is measured actually in over 100 miles. So that even though Noble's idea seemed outlandish at the time, he was still a factor of 10 short as to how much horizontal motion has gone on the San Andreas Fault.
Well, I think it was, a lot of what I'm remembering here is from your book, John, actually. And you know, about pinnacles and.
Oh, and isn't it the Nenach Formation in Southern California? There's volcanic rocks in Southern California, and the pinnacles, and that's like, you know, they're 100-some-odd miles apart, and Pinnacles National Park, where the rocks are on the west side. The matching rocks are down there in Southern California, and it's just amazing to think about that. Those rocks were together, you know, and the San Andreas Fault has displaced them so far.
That's right. There are these there's a pile of volcanic rocks, and it's been split by the San Andreas Fault, and one is on the north side. And the south has been displaced about 140 miles off to the east.
Yeah, it's up. It's up near the Tejon Pass region. It's up around there. I'd like to find out from both of you, like when did and who was it that actually determined that this huge fault that runs from Cape Mendocino all the way down to the Salton Sea, that Lawson had identified as a fault, and then. Noble had, you know, come up with the idea that there was these huge offsets, and he, you know, understood what was going on, if not the scale of it. When did it become an actual thing that we said, this is an actual plate boundary between two of the Earth's tectonic plates, the Pacific plate to the west and the North American plate to the east? When did the San Andreas Fault, when did that realization come?
Well, when the San Andreas Fault was first realized to be part of the global tectonic system, you know, of the entire Earth, that's really in 1965 when a man named Tuzo Wilson introduces the idea of a tectonic plate, that the outer rind of the Earth was divided into a dozen or so rigid plates that were constantly pushing and grinding against each other. And if you think of it, these plates, they either will collide with each other, forming mountains, such as the Himalayas. They'll pull apart from each other, forming things like what's known as the mid-ocean ridge. But there's a third possibility, that they slide horizontally. And that's what the San Andreas Fault is. It's the horizontal sliding of two plates, the North American and the Pacific plate.
Well, one of the, you know, the title of your book is Earthquake Storms, and Ken tweeted me something that I think was an article you wrote about this, that you draw a comparison between a series of earthquakes that happened, I think, on the Anatolia Fault, is that correct?
Yes, in Turkey.
Yeah, and that could be analogous to what could lie ahead or could have been in the past in California. We just don't know. Could you explain to us what you mean by an earthquake storm?
Well, one of the things we know about large earthquakes is that they don't occur episodically and they don't occur randomly, but they seem to occur sort of in bunches. And the classic one for a San Andreas type, those are strike slip or horizontal motion, is a fault that runs over the northern part of Turkey, known as the North Anatolian Fault. It's very similar to the San Andreas, similar in length, similar in the amount of motion. But what happened there, from east to west, there was a series of earthquakes. I think they begin in the 1930s, and we're probably close to the end of it. But there's been something like over a dozen major earthquakes, meaning 6.5 or above, in less than a century. And everyone I have ever spoken to at the Geological Survey, Stanford, Berkeley, USC, and so forth, I've asked, is this possible in the San Andreas? And they say, of course.
And what's the thinking on that that you hear from your friends and colleagues in the USGS, Ken?
Oh, what John said is definitely right, that with the North Anatolian sequence that we find that not only fascinating in its own right, but possibly instructive in terms of what we should expect from the future of the San Andreas Fault system. Thought is evolving on what we should expect in the future. When we talk about a big one, we tend to talk about the 1857 earthquake down in Southern California on the San Andreas Fault, and also the 1906 earthquake, the great San Francisco earthquake and fire. There's been more talk in recent years, though, of the possibility of an even bigger earthquake than the two that we find so noteworthy historically. Each of those was about a magnitude 7.8 or 7.9, we think, from what we can tell. So, of course, the 1857 earthquake, we don't have any instrumental records at all. So it's a little hard to know the earlier you get in history. But I guess it's possible that we could have an earthquake on the San Andreas Fault system that's even bigger than that.
And would that be the one that your colleagues are talking about that starts down maybe north of the Salt and Trough area? Is that the region you're thinking of?
Oh, the Coachella Valley, where they have the big concerts, that's the southernmost part of the San Andreas Fault. And it's been over 300 years approximately since the last big earthquake down there that's been documented through offset strata that have been radiocarbon dated by my colleagues. And so on average, the recurrence interval is about half that. In other words, it's been a quite a long time, and the strain has been accumulating such that you could have a large earthquake starting down in the Coachella Valley. The next question is, well, could it break out of the Coachella Valley through this complex area called the San Gorgonio Pass and then keep going? Some of us think that that's plausible. That was the basis for the shakeout scenario that we did. That was a 7.8 magnitude earthquake starting down next to the Salton Sea, going right on past Palm Springs and then past Cajon Pass and right on along the Mojave section of the San Andreas Fault, right past where Levi Noble used to live. So that would be roughly a 300-kilometer long rupture. It would take a few hundred seconds to occur, and it'd be a magnitude 7.8. So some even think that you could get a bigger rupture than that on the southern San Andreas Fault. It might keep on going.
Wow. And one of the other things I found interesting is that people don't think about this, but there's also an earthquake fault that goes through the Lake Tahoe region. Is that right?
In recent years, one of the technologies that we've been using to make detailed topographical maps is airborne LIDAR. And what that can do is it can make it as if you've removed all the trees from the landscape. So you can see, as if with new eyes, you can see the bare earth. And in the Lake Tahoe area, this has been done. Airborne LIDAR has been used to investigate and explore active faults in that area, and it's been very revealing. Indeed, there are active faults on the sides of Lake Tahoe, and in many places, airborne LIDAR has been used to reveal faults that had not been mapped previously. Another area, the Puget Sound lowlands up by Seattle, LIDAR was used to show lots of faults that had not been previously documented. Some had not been known at all, and some had only been suggested, hinted at, and the LIDAR just showed us exactly what the faults look like, and so people were able to map those.
I guess the bottom line for that is that wherever you live in the Western United States, you're in a seismically dangerous zone.
Yes, wherever you live in Western U.S., you shouldn't be surprised if there is a destructive earthquake. But that also goes for the center of the country, you know, in the southeast of Missouri and also across to New England.
Oh, yeah. And the New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 and 1812 were huge. Before we go, I know you wrote a wonderful book. I think it's called The Last Volcano. About a man named Thomas Jagger. And did you go and witness the eruptions on the Big Island last year? Because we really had a lot of volcanic activity there.
Yes, I worked for many years at the institution started by Professor Jagger. It's known as the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. And though I'm retired, there was a lot to do. And so I did get deeply involved in the recent eruption over at Kilauea, both at the spectacular amount of lava that was pouring out of the ground and the collapse that was occurring up at the summit of the volcano. For 62 days, we had a magnitude 5.5 earthquake. And it was just a phenomenal amount of activity to actually witness.
Wow. Earthquakes and volcanoes. That's like plate tectonics, you know, all unfolding right there.
Right. Every day for 62 days, we had a 5.5 earthquake.
Wow. That's amazing. Before we go, anything you would like to ask John and Ken?
Oh, yeah. On that volcano theme, John, it was a delight to meet you at the Volcano House, where we had that great view out over the caldera at Kilauea. I know that at the time when we talked that you were thinking about the significance of the explosivity of the eruptions there and whether it might be possible that an eruption even larger than what we witnessed in 2018 might occur there in the future. I was just wondering about your latest thoughts on that.
Well, when this activity was going on, we weren't sure how long and the way that it was going to end. We know from the geologic record, from the very recent one of just a few hundred years ago, that there was a very large fire fountain that created massive fires in the area. But then on August 3rd, the eruption stopped within a matter of hours, and the volcano has been quiet since then. And that, of course, gets us to scratching our heads. Is it going to go into a long period, meaning for decades of quiet? Or is the lava going to come back slowly? And I really just have to say right now, it's a wait and see out on the island of Hawaii.
Well, people ask me all the time why I like geology and so much. And I say, you know, rocks are very interesting. They have incredible stories to tell us. But when they break or erupt, they become downright fascinating.
Yes, when they're moving, when they're hot. That's when I had the epiphany of my life, watching an explosion. So yes, it's very awe. It's truly awe when you see a volcanic eruption.
Could you briefly tell us about that experience? When was that?
Oh, the epiphany?
Yeah. When was that?
Oh, I have to caution you. I've told friends this, and I can go on for a long time.
Well, you'll have to give us the 3-minute version.
Right. I'll give you the version that belongs in a Reader's Digest. It was May 17, 1982, and I was the only American, USGS, through the State Department, working on volcanoes on the island of Java. And a volcano named Galungun had started to erupt. And so we marshaled what we could in terms of one seismometer and a few other things. And on that evening, well, during the day, we had walked up into the crater, installed everything. We saw that there were a lot of cracks. And then that evening, May 17, 1982, I remember very clearly, you could hear it. We looked up at the mountain, and I describe it as was like the hand of God coming up out of the ground. It was this brilliant red-orange. It shot up thousands of feet. It opened up like the ribs of an umbrella, and then it all went dark. And then about 30 seconds later, we saw the red start to appear again. And over a course of maybe a minute, this molten stuff, which was actually very hot ash, started to pour out over the crater like oatmeal boiling over a kettle, and we could see it running down. And that very much changed my view of nature and of life.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Good to be at a safe distance. Even 2 miles can be not far enough, as they found out at Mount St. Helens back in 1980.
That is true.
Before we let you go, John, are you working on another book? Because both The Last Volcano and Earthquake Storms are just really fascinating, readable books. You got anything you're working on now?
Yes. I'm working on a book called Creating a Continent, A Radical New History of North America. Very short, it's the story of how North America formed, how it evolved, and how its ancient past really controls a great deal of our lives. When you think of the economic resources, when you think of this thing that we're talking about, this debate of climate change, well, the climate has changed a great deal, and we have a very detailed record of it. in North America. People are changing their ideas about the cause of earthquakes in Missouri and in New England. And sort of the punchline is, we need to understand that humanity is now a geologic force. That just as we think, we look at the geologic past of the Earth, we think of mountain building, earthquakes, and so forth. Well, what human beings are doing is a major geologic, is going to have major implications in the evolution of the planet now.
Wow. Well, we'll look forward to reading that. And when it comes out, we'll be sure to have you back on.
Well, thank you.
I thought of one more thing I'd like to ask John, if that'd be okay, Dave. Do you have a favorite story about Thomas Jaeger and his adventures?
Oh, well, I have a favorite story. Yes, it involves him and his second wife. So September 1919, and Thomas and Isabel Jaeger have been married for 2 years. And they live in a house that is perched right on the edge of a 400-foot cliff. And as they go to bed each night, in their bedroom on the crater side is just a very large window. And about a mile away is a lava lake. And so for the first 2 years of their marriage, they never had to use a kerosene lantern because the lava lake was always illuminating the bedroom. But one night, and Isabel was the lighter sleeper, Isabel was woken by an earthquake. She sits up in bed and looks out at the lava lake a mile away. And she says, as I looked at it, in about 10 seconds, it grew brighter than I had ever seen before. And then in another 10 seconds, it went completely dark. And she said, I turned over and looked at my husband, and the volcanologist was asleep. The most famous volcanologist in the world had slept through all of this.
That's a good story. Well, John Dvorak and Ken Hudnut, thanks for so much for joining us on Blue Dot. It was really fascinating to talk about our restless planet.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks, John, for writing these wonderful books and for sharing them with us.
Thanks again to our guests, John Dvorak and Ken Hudnut. Dvorak is the author of Earthquake Storms, The Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault, and The Last Volcano, A Man, A Romance, and the Quest to Understand Nature's Most Magnificent Fury. Hudnut is the science advisor for risk reduction at the United States Geological Survey in Pasadena. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.